WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, George Will, is one of America's foremost columnists and commentators. He's been described as a national version of the smartest boy in the class. One of the frustrations he has been spared in his life is not getting his opinions heard. He writes a syndicated newspaper column, a column in Newsweek, and he's a panelist each Sunday morning on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. Will won a Pulitzer Prize for criticism in 1977. A little later, we'll talk about how Will went from supporting Kennedy in college to becoming one of America's leading conservative journalists. But first, we're going to focus on the subject of his new book, Restoration, in which he argues that term limits are necessary to restore Congress to competence and respect. Will supports limiting members of the House and Senate to no more than 12 consecutive years. Will says he came slowly and reluctantly, but firmly, to accept the need for term limits. He told me what finally convinced him.
Several things. The accumulated weight of the evidence of how Washington works, or more precisely does not work, how it budgets or fails to conduct the fundamental act of governance, which is to budget, the unwillingness to make rational choices. Then there were some specific episodes. When I had always opposed term limits on the grounds that we needed what were called seasoned professionals here in Washington and couldn't have amateurs. It was pointed out to me that etymologically the word amateur comes from the French word to love and means someone who does something for the love of it, and that didn't seem to me like such a bad motive, even in public life. I concluded that it was seasoned professionals, and because they were seasoned professionals that gave us the deficits we have and the savings and loan debacle and much else. Furthermore, I had opposed term limits on the grounds that the lobbyists would run roughshod over the rookies if we had a constant rotation in office. But then I noticed, particularly in California, when they voted on Proposition 140 limiting their state legislative terms in 1990, that the people who opposed them most ferociously were the lobbyists. And I noticed that in Washington, the group most adamantly opposed to term limits are lobbyists, because they have long-term, mutually beneficial relationships with career legislators who are tamed, wired, and rented by these people. And they don't want anything to disturb this very comfortable, I believe, ruinous relationship.
Why do you think term limits would make it easier for people in Congress to cast unpopular votes?
Because they would not be afraid. They would not be as risk-averse. They would be people probably who came to Congress from other careers who would know coming into Congress that they had to have careers to go back to. And therefore, the prospect of losing an election would not be personal annihilation and oblivion. Therefore, they could think of the next generation and not simply the next election.
You've talked about the mediocrity of American presidents. Do you think that presidents who are subjected to a two-term limit maybe disprove the theory? Do you know what I mean? That with term limits, politicians improve?
I don't think so. I think the executive branch poses its own problems relative to the legislative branch. But first of all, how many presidents have we wanted for four more years after what we've had? Not very many. I think most people would agree that after 8 years, an administration is stale. The people who came with the president are tired. The ideas are exhausted. Indeed, you could argue that you're seeing today a third term of a sort of pale imitation of Ronald Reagan, and the exhaustion's manifest.
Well, this is a year of real house cleaning in the Congress. There are so many incumbents who aren't running and so many newcomers who are. So do you think that there's a natural process going on now that maybe would make term limits unnecessary?
No, quite the contrary. What this year's turnover demonstrates is it takes a concatenation of highly unnatural circumstances to break the logjam. Normally, we have enormous numbers of incumbents seeking re-election, and 98% of those seeking re-election winning it. Indeed, since 1948, I believe only four times has the re-election rate for incumbents dipped below 90% and only as low as 86%. What you've got this year is redistricting, a law that allows people retiring to take private for their own benefit remaining campaign funds, the House check-cashing scandal, the House post office scandal, and an unprecedented level of general disgust. I, for one, do not want to rely on this kind of constellation of disasters to produce regular rotation in office. And what strikes me is how many people, including a lot of opponents of term limits, say, you see, you don't need term limits because we're having this wonderful turnover. Well, if it's wonderful, let's institutionalize it.
And you think that this is just a...
I think it's a fluke.
A function of the scandals, and it's a fluke.
That's right.
What about the argument, why not let the good people stay and just vote out the bad ones?
It's very hard to vote out an incumbent because the modern state lends itself in all its myriad regulating and subsidizing activities to becoming an incumbency protection machine. The vast majority of campaign contributions go to incumbents simply because they are so apt to win. So it's a self-fulfilling prophecy on the part of the interest groups. In 1990, almost half the half the incumbents running for re-election were either opposed or, as they say, financially virtually unopposed. That is, their opponents, they either had no opponent or their opponent had less than $25,000. That's a derisory amount. They're simply not competitive. So it's extremely difficult to compete with people who can use the modern state to shower their constituencies with favors. You see, I believe that the founders were right not to include term limits. It is a restriction on choice. You shouldn't restrict choices unless it's necessary. What then has made it necessary? It is the intersection of human nature with the nature of the modern government.
But you could still be a career politician even if there were term limits, because you could go from the House to the Senate. You could start your career. You could have a long career in city and state politics before even going
precisely,
to national politics.
Precisely, and that is indeed what the normal career pattern was from the time of Jefferson until early into this century, when the state began to grow and Washington became worth staying in and indeed became comfortable enough because it had air conditioning and all the rest, that people wanted to make lives here. Indeed, some of the term limit initiatives on state ballots this fall say that you can run, say, if you're restricted to 6 terms in the House, 12 years. Some of the initiatives say you can run for a 7th consecutive term, but you have to do it by write-in. You can't receive a major party nomination a 7th term. It's worth noting that term limits are on 15 state ballots this year, including such large states as Ohio, Michigan, Florida, and California. These 15 states have about a third of the American population, and as the Wall Street Journal pointed out just the other day, this is as close as we have come in American history to having a national referendum on a subject.
Do you think in a way that the larger problem might be the quality of people politics is attracting now?
I think it is. You know, a great many of the best people in Washington, the kind of people who, if we're going to have career politicians you wish would make careers of it, are now leaving. And they're leaving because, paradoxically, the climate of careerism, the smallness, the inability to make large decisions, the preoccupation with individual political entrepreneurship on the part of careerists has made life here simply unpleasant. I'm thinking of, say, a man like Vin Weber, 40-year-old Republican from Minnesota, has just thrown up his hands and said, this is not the way I want to spend my life.
You said you came to this idea reluctantly. Why were you reluctant to be on the side of term limits?
Because I'd been on the other side vociferously. I mean, I'd written a number of columns with customary verve and certitude against term limits. But more than that, as a conservative, I'm very reluctant to change the Constitution. That's something one should do with trepidation, in part because of the law of unintended consequences, which is one reason why a number of us conservatives are conservatives. The law of unintended consequences being that the unintended consequences of a reform are apt to be larger than and diametrically opposed to the intended ones. And term limits, you know, is a peculiar reform because you know going in, you know that one of its absolutely certain results will be unfortunate. And that is, it will truncate some excellent careers. I have dedicated my book to two couples who are among my best friends, Liz and Pat Moynihan and Jack and Sally Danforth, Republican and Democratic senators, who've been here longer than my proposal would permit them to stay. But I just have to face the fact, I think on balance, the good outweighs the bad.
You were very briefly in politics. In 1970, I think it was, you worked for the senator from Colorado.
Gordon Allott, that's right.
Yeah. So what got you into politics and what got you out very quickly?
Well, I was teaching. I taught for a year at Michigan State and then for a year and a half at the University of Toronto teaching political philosophy. And got invited to come to Washington and work for a senator. And I said, well, that'd be fun. So I came down, liked it here. In 1972, in my third year with him, he lost. He'd won five statewide elections till I went to work for him. I don't know what that says about my help I gave him. But anyway, he lost. And so I decided to stay in Washington and became a columnist. I loved Congress, and I certainly harbor no animus against Congress. The title of my book, Restoration, is meant to indicate that I want to restore Congress to the primacy I think it rightfully has under the Constitution as the first branch of government. It is, after all, Article I, and it is the initiator of laws, the passer of laws, the initiator of spending. It's the most important branch, and one of, I would hope, one of the consequences of term limits would be to shrink the presidency back to its proper constitutional proportions. You know, it's fascinating to me that television and the Cold War arrived in America almost simultaneously and had the reinforcing effect of inflating the presidency. Television is a slave to a superficial news-gathering instrument, a camera. The camera has to be pointed at something. It's often pointed at the president. It's just a simple way to solve your problem with that device. And the president has been on this bright, well-lit stage in this international melodrama, followed around for 40 years by the man, the military aide, carrying the nuclear launch codes. The whole effect was to inflate the presidency and put Congress into an anti-constitutional eclipse. And it's that that I would hope term limits would help to rectify.
Yeah, well, along those lines, what do you have to say when the president accuses Congress of, causing a gridlock and preventing his legislation, when the people in Congress were elected as much as the president was?
Well, I agree with
they're
that.
They're doing the people's will as much as the president is.
I agree with that. Furthermore, I think the American people are voting for gridlock. When the American people produce, as they have for 40 years, almost constantly for 40 years, divided government, I don't think it's a fluke. The political scientists have a formulation. They say the American people are ideologically conservative and operationally liberal. That is, they think of themselves, and when voting for president, use their vote to make a kind of ideologically defining statement, they think of themselves in Jeffersonian terms, that government is best, that governs least, and all that. Then they turn around, and when they vote for senators on down to city council, the people who actually legislate bridges and roads and pensions and medical care and teacher salaries and all the rest, then they have a voracious appetite for government. They just have a negligible willingness to pay for it. And therefore, in a sense, we're the system that's producing gridlock that looks as though America has a very divided mind is in fact representing, it's a representative process. It's representing accurately the turmoil in the national mind.
Do you think if we did have term limits, that those limits would encourage more intellectual, philosophical people to run for office?
I think so, because they would not look upon term limits on a career in politics, the way people look on a career in selling aluminum siding or shoes or hardware or dentistry or veterinary medicine or anything else. It wouldn't be just a vocation. It would be a departure from the pattern of your life that you would make because you cared about something, not just keeping your job, but issues, reforms you'd like to see affected, something wrong with America that bothers you and you'd like to correct. You'd come, take a crack at it, and then leave the way people used to.
One of the really big problems now is in order to run for office, you really have to be pretty wealthy. And don't you think that's one of the fundamental problems in politics now, that it's this real limited group of people who even have access to office?
It certainly is the case that the Senate is, shall we say, amply stocked with millionaires. It is not quite the same way in the House, but it's getting that way. That the alternative to being wealthy is to spend all of your time raising money. Indeed, if you're wealthy in the Senate, you spend all of your time raising money. The estimate now is that on average, and of course the averages vary from, say, Vermont to California and the expensiveness of a Senate race, but on average, a senator seeking re-election has to begin the day he's elected and raise $10,000 a week every week for the next 6 years. It's a grueling, degrading, demoralizing process.
If you're just joining us, my guest is George Will. He's written a new book called Restoration, Congress, Term Limits, and the Recovery of Deliberative Democracy. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. George Will is my guest. He's written a new book about congressional term limits. It's called Restoration. You recently wrote about how presidents are so often mediocre now, and you called President Bush the weakest incumbent to seek re-election since Andrew Johnson in 1868. You've described Clinton as so far the weakest challenger since John Davis, the man who took Democrats 103 ballots to nominate in 1924. And more recently, you wrote, the search for reasons to re-elect George Bush resembles for many the 19th century search for the source of the Blue Nile, hard going. So how are you deciding between the two of them?
with trepidation, I'm going to put it off as long as possible.
So you really haven't made up your mind?
I genuinely haven't. And I think in this regard, if in no other, I'd rather reflect the American public. Normally, the rule of thumb is that when the campaign turns the corner past Labor Day, that only at most 20% of the country is truly undecided, so that all the miles traveled and money spent in that period is aimed at influencing 20% of the country. This year, I think it if you count the very, very soft attachments to both candidates, it could be as much as 50%.
You weren't exactly enthusiastic about George Bush when he ran in 1988 in a column about the 5,000 reasons to support George Bush. The 5,000 reasons were the 5,000 people who were presidential appointees in one way or another. You figured, well, at least they'd be Republicans. Has he surprised you in any way?
No. Alas. I mean, my expectations were so low that almost any surprise would have been on the positive side. No, you see, what I hold against George Bush is not what he, as they say, has done to the economy. I don't think presidents run the economy. I don't think they can. I don't think they should try to. I think we have business cycles with or without presidents. He made some mistakes that injured the economy a bit. But basically, the economy was going to have a rough patch here. What I object to about Mr. Bush is what he's done to our politics. He has drained it of ideas. And when you drain politics of ideas, cynicism fills the vacuum. And you have these manipulators, he goes into what he calls his campaign mode, which to him means it has nothing to do with what he'd do if reelected. And that's, I think we have a politics without the ballast of conviction.
Do you consider President Bush to be more cynical than the average politician?
Yes.
In what way?
Well, consider the contrast with his predecessor. One doesn't have to agree with a syllable that Ronald Reagan said. You can still concede the fact that he was, in the phrase the British coined really to apply to Margaret Thatcher, a conviction politician. The world is divided between those who go into politics because they want to be something and those who go into politics because they want to do something. Reagan wanted to do something. Mr. Bush, I'm afraid, wanted to be something.
You wrote that today honorable conservatives feel the sort of fury felt by honorable conservatives 40 years ago when Joe McCarthy was giving anti-communism a bad name. Who are the conservatives that honorable conservatives feel embarrassed by now?
Well, Pat Buchanan in some of his modes, proclaiming a religious war in this rather tranquil and happy country. Pat Robertson saying that, in fact, the Clintons, he and she, have devised a strategy to destroy the American family. I mean, one, I can make the case against Bill Clinton as well as the next guy, but it's preposterous to say that is the case against them.
How comfortable are you with the alliance between conservatives and the religious right?
Well, the evangelicals come in many shapes and sizes, and the religious right does too. When the involvement of the religious elements of American society in politics was Jesse Jackson and Martin Luther King and the Southern Christian Leadership Congress, no one saw anything wrong with that. It's when the religious communities in America became alarmed by some cultural trends and wound up in the Republican Party that people began to find this ominous. I don't find it ominous. I believe that cultural issues from abortion through the caliber and nature of our public education are quite legitimate political issues. They're questions about how we ought to live. So I'm not alarmed by that. I'm alarmed by the temperament of some of the representatives of that camp. But the phenomenon itself is not disturbing.
Do you think that some of the representatives of that camp are trying to blur the distinction between church and state?
Well, they may be, but they won't get anywhere. I mean, if there is any constitutional principle that is settled and sturdy at the moment, it is the Supreme Court's insistence on what Jefferson in that famous letter referred to as the wall of separation between church and state. The court has developed that three-prong test for testing the constitutionality of any state action touching religion. And so the idea that an election result might result in a theocracy in the United States is not a worry I entertain.
Each Sunday, you and Sam Donaldson ask very sharp questions to politicians and political leaders, and then you have a very spirited discussion about the issues of the day, joined by other people. I wonder what you think of the kind of pundit shows that are much more theatrical in nature, like McLaughlin's show and Evans and Novak's show.
Well, I don't see Evans and Novak often. I've seen the McLaughlin show a few times, and enough to know that it seems to have earned its nickname as the gong show of journalism. I don't think it's consonant with the basic dignity of political discourse. I mean, political discourse can be vigorous, Lord knows, without being so cacophonous that it's hard to follow. And second, without giving the impression, a dangerous one for the profession of journalism, without giving the impression that there's an act going on, that it's vaudeville carried on by other means, that people have sort of assigned roles and come out and mud wrestle on cue.
Do you think that there is a shortage of public conservative intellectuals or of conservative intellectuals that are used on broadcasting?
No, I don't. I think actually we're doing rather well on the conservative side in opinion journalism, particularly if you count the op-ed pages of America's newspapers. Frankly, I think I'm the only person who's ever had what I've got at the moment, which is a regular network television exposure, the back page of a national news magazine, and a syndicated column. Sapphire, Buckley, Buchanan, Kirkpatrick, Kilpatrick, lots of others. In fact, if I were an editor of a newspaper, I'd probably be most anxious to find fresh liberal voices.
George Will is a political columnist and a panelist on ABC's This Week with David Brinkley. His new book about congressional term limits is called Restoration. George Will be back with us on the second half of today's show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.